Wolf Hall, Disc 4.
Now the Cardinal's many bags are packed for France. His entourage yields little in splendour to the one with which he crossed 7 years ago, to the field of the cloth of gold. His itinerary is leisurely before he embarks: Dartford, Rochester, Faversham, Canterbury for 3 or 4 days, prayers at the Shrine of Becket. "So, Thomas," he says, "if you know the King's had Anne, get a letter to me the very day. I'll only trust it if I hear it from you. How will you know it's happened? I should think you'll know by his face. And if you have not the honour of seeing it..." "Good point. I wish I had presented you. I should have taken the chance while I had it." "If the King doesn't tire of Anne quickly," he tells the Cardinal, "I don't see what you are to do. We know princes please themselves, and usually it's possible to put some gloss on their actions. But what case can you make for Boleyn's daughter? What does she bring him? No treaty, no land, no money. How are you to present it as a creditable match at all?" Wolsey sits with his elbows on his desk, his fingers dabbing his closed lids. He takes a great breath and begins to talk. He begins to talk about England. "You can't know Albion," he says, "unless you can go back before Albion was thought of. You must go back before Caesar's legions, to the days when the bones of giant animals and men lay on the ground where one day London would be built. You must go back to the new Troy, the new Jerusalem, and the sins and the crimes of the kings who rode under the tattered banners of Arthur, and who married women who came out of the sea or hatched out of eggs, women with scales and fins and feathers. Beside which," he says, "the match with Anne looks less unusual." "These are old stories," he says, "but some people, let us remember, do believe them." He speaks of the deaths of kings, of how the second Richard vanished into Pontefract Castle and was murdered there or starved, how the fourth Henry, the usurper, died of a leprosy which so scarred and contracted his body that it was the size of a mannequin or child. He talks of the fifth Henry's victories in France and the price, not in money, to be paid for Agincourt. He talks of the French princess whom that great prince married. She was a sweet lady, but her father was insane and believed that he was made of glass. From this marriage, fifth Henry and the glass princess, sprung another Henry who ruled an England dark as winter, cold, barren, calamitous. Edward Plantagenet, son of the Duke of York, came as the first sign of spring. He was a native of Aries, the sign under which the whole world was made. When Edward was 18 years old, he seized the kingdom, and he did it because of a sign he received. His troops were baffled and battle-weary. It was the darkest time of one of God's darkest years, and he had just heard the news that should have broken him. His father and his youngest brother had been captured, mocked, and slaughtered by the Lancastrian forces. It was Candlemas, huddled in his tent with his generals. He prayed for the slaughtered souls. St. Blaise's Day came, 3rd of February, black and icy. At 10 in the morning, 3 suns rose in the sky, 3 blurred disks of silver, sparkling and hazy through particles of frost. Their garland of light spread over the sorry fields, over the sodden forests of the Welsh borderlands, over his demoralised and unpaid troops. His men knelt in prayer on the frozen ground. His knights genuflected to the sky. His whole life took wing and soared. In that wash of brilliant light he saw his future. When no one else could see, he could see. And that's what it means to be a king. At the Battle of Mortimer's Cross, he took prisoner one Owen Tudor. He beheaded him in Hereford Marketplace and set his head to rot on the Market Cross. An unknown woman brought a basin of water and washed the severed head. She combed its bloody hair. From then on, St. Blaise's Day, the 3 suns shining, every time he touched his sword, he touched it to win. 3 months later he was in London and he was king. But he never saw the future again, not clearly as he had that year. Dazzled, he stumbled through his kingship as through a mist. He was entirely the creature of astrologers, of holy men and fantasists. He didn't marry as he should, for foreign advantage, but became enmeshed in a series of half-made, half-broken promises to an unknown number of women. One of them was the Talbot girl, Eleanor by name. And what was special about her? It was said she was descended, in the female line, from a woman who was a swan. And why did he fasten his affection finally on the widow of a Lancastrian knight? Was it because, as some people thought, her cold blonde beauty raised his pulse? It was not exactly that. It was that she claimed descent from the serpent woman Melusine, whom you may see in old parchments winding her coils about the Tree of Knowledge and presiding over the union of the moon and the sun. Melusine faked her life as an ordinary princess, a mortal, but one day her husband saw her naked and glimpsed her serpent's tail. As she slid from his grip, she predicted that her children would found a dynasty that would reign forever. Power with no limit, guaranteed by the devil. She slid away, says the cardinal, and no one ever saw her again. Some of the candles have gone out. Wolsey does not call for more lights.
So you see, he says, King Edward's advisers were planning to marry him to a French princess, as I have intended. And look what happened instead. Look how he chose.
How long is that, since Melusine? It is late. The whole great palace of York Place is quiet, the city sleeping, the river creeping in its channels, silting its banks. In these matters, the cardinal says, there is no measure of time. These spirits slip from our hands and through the ages, serpentine, mutable, sly.
But the woman King Edward married, she brought, did she not, a claim to the throne of Castile? Very ancient, very obscure.
The cardinal nods.
That was the meaning of the three sons, the throne of England, the throne of France, and the throne of Castile. So when our present king married Catherine, he was moving closer to his ancient rights. Not that anyone, I imagine, dared put it in those terms to Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand. But it is as well to remember and mention from time to time that our king is the ruler of three kingdoms, if each had their own.
By your account, my lord, our king's Plantagenet grandfather beheaded his Tudor great-grandfather.
A thing to know, but not to mention.
And the Boleyns? I thought they were merchants. But should I have known they had serpent fangs or wings?
You were laughing at me, Master Cromwell.
Indeed not. But I want the best information, if you are leaving me to watch the situation for you. The cardinal then talks about killing. He talks about sin, about what's to be expiated. He talks about the sixth King Henry, murdered in the Tower, of King Richard born under Scorpio, the sign of secret dealings, tribulation and vice. At Bosworth, where the scorpion died, bad choices were made. The Duke of Norfolk fought on the losing side, and his heirs were turned out of their dukedom. They had to work hard, long and hard, to get it back. So do you wonder, he says, why the Norfolk that is now shakes sometimes, if the king is in a temper? It's because he thinks he will lose all he has at an angry man's whim. The cardinal sees his man make a mental note, and he speaks of the loose rattling bones under the paving of the Tower, those bones bricked into staircases and mulched into the Thames mud. He talks about King Edward's two vanished sons, the younger of them prone to stubborn resurrections that almost threw Henry Tudor out of his kingdom. He speaks of the coins the Pretender struck, stamped with their message to the Tudor king. Your days are numbered, you are weighed in the balance and found wanting. He speaks of the fear that was then of the return of civil war. Catherine was contracted to be married into England, had been called Princess of Wales since she was 3 years old. But before her family would let her embark from Corunna, they exacted a price in blood and bone. They asked Henry to turn his attention to the chief Plantagenet claimant, the nephew of King Edward and wicked King Richard, whom he had held in the Tower since he was a child of 10.
To gentle pressure, King Henry capitulated. The White Rose, aged 24, was taken out into God's light and air in order to have his head cut off. But there was always another White Rose, the Plantagenet's breed, though not unsupervised.
There will always be the need for more killing. One must, says the Cardinal, have the stomach for it, I suppose, though I don't know I ever have. I'm always ill when there's an execution. I pray for them, these old dead people. I even pray for wicked King Richard sometimes, though Thomas More tells me he is burning in hell.
Wolsey looks down at his own hands, twists the rings on his fingers.
I wonder, he murmurs, wonder which it is.
Those who envy the Cardinal say he has a ring which enables its owner to fly and allows him to encompass the death of his enemies. It detects poisons, renders ferocious beasts harmless, ensures the favour of princes, and protects against drowning. I suppose other people know, my lord, because they have employed conjurers to try to get it copied.
If I knew I'd get it copied myself, I'd give one to you.
I picked up a snake once in Italy.
Why did you do that?
For a bet.
Was it poisonous?
We didn't know. That was the point of the bet.
Did it bite you?
Of course.
Why, of course?
It wouldn't be much of a story, would it, if I'd put it down unharmed and away it slid? Unwittingly, the Cardinal laughs.
What will I do without you, he says, among the double-tongued French?
In the house at Austin Friars, Liz is in bed, but she stirs in her sleep. She half wakes, says his name, and inches into his arms. He kisses her hair and says, Our king's grandfather married a serpent. Liz murmurs,
Am I awake or asleep?
A heartbeat, and she slides away from him and turns over, throwing out an arm. He wonders what she will dream. He lies awake, thinking. All that Edward did, his battles, his conquests, he did with Medici money behind him. Their letters of credit were more important than signs and wonders. If King Edward was, as many people say, not the son of his father at all, not the son of the Duke of York, if King Edward's mother, as some people do believe, had bred him from an honest English soldier, an archer called Blaybourn, then if Edward married a serpent woman, his offspring would be... Unreliable is the word that comes to mind. If all the old stories are to be believed, and some people, let us remember, do believe them, then our king is one part bastard archer, one part hidden serpent, one part Welsh, and all of him in debt to the Italian banks. He too slides, drifts towards sleep. His accounting fails. The spectral world moves in, where pages of figures used to be. Try always, the Cardinal says, to learn what people wear under their clothes, for it's not just their skin. Turn the king inside out, and he will find his scaly ancestors, his warm, solid, serpentine flesh. When, in Italy, he had picked up a snake for a bet, he had to hold it till they counted 10. They counted rather slowly in the slower languages. Eins, zwei, drei. At 4, the startled snake flicked its head and bit him. Between 4 and 5, he tightened his grip. Now, some cried, Blood of Christ, drop it! Some prayed and some swore. Some just kept on counting. The snake looked sick. When they had all reached 10, and not before, he eased its coiled body gently to the ground and let it slip away into its future. There was no pain, but one could see clearly the puncture wound. On instinct, he tasted it, almost bit his own wrist. He noticed, surprised by it, the private white English flesh of his inner arm. He saw the narrow blue-green veins into which the snake had slipped the poison. He collected his winnings. He waited to die, but he never did die. If anything, he got stronger, quick to hide and quick to strike. There was no Milanese quartermaster could outball him, No bought-in Bernese capitaine who would not fall back before his grim reputation for blood first and bargaining later. Tonight is hot. It is July. He is asleep. He dreams. Somewhere in Italy, a snake has children. He calls his children Thomas. They carry in their heads pictures of the Thames, of muddy, shallow banks beyond the reach of the tide, beyond the wash of the water. Next morning, when he wakes, Liz is still sleeping. The sheets are damp. She is warm and flushed, her face smooth like a young girl's. He kisses her hairline. She tastes of salt. She murmurs, "Tell me when you're coming home." "Liz, I'm not going," he says. "I'm not going with Wolsey." He leaves her. His barber comes to shave him. He sees his own eyes in a polished mirror. They look alive, serpent eyes. "What a strange dream," he says to himself. As he goes downstairs, he thinks he sees Liz following him. He thinks he sees the flash of her white cap. He turns and says, "Liz, go back to bed." But she's not there. He is mistaken. He picks up his papers and goes to Gray's Inn. It is recess. The business is not legal. The discussion is of texts and the whereabouts of Tyndale, somewhere in Germany. And the immediate problem is a fellow lawyer, so who shall say he should not be there, visiting Gray's Inn, called Thomas Bilney, who is a priest also and a fellow of Trinity Hall. Little Bilney, he's called, on account of his short stature and worm-like attributes. He sits twisting on a bench and talking about his mission to lepers. "The scriptures, to me, are as honey," says little Bilney, swivelling his meagre bottom and kicking his shrunken legs. "I am drunk on the word of God." "For Christ's sake, man," he says, "don't think you can crawl out of your hole because the cardinal is away, because now the Bishop of London has his hands free, not to mention our friend in Chelsea." "Masses, fasting, vigils, pardons out of purgatory, all useless," Bilney says. "This is revealed to me. All that remains, in effect, is to go to Rome and discuss it with His Holiness. I am sure he will come over to my way of thinking." "You think your viewpoint is original, do you?" he says gloomily. "Still, at that, it may be, Father Bilney, if you think the Pope would welcome your advice in these matters." He goes out, saying, "There's one who will jump into the fire, given an invitation. Masters, be careful there." He doesn't take Rafe to these meetings. He will not draw any member of his household into dangerous company. The Cromwell household is as orthodox as any in London, and as pious. They must be, he says, irreproachable. The rest of the day is nothing to remember. He would have been home early if he had not arranged to meet up in the German enclave, the Steelyard, with a man from Rostock, who brought along a friend from Stettin, who offered to teach him some Polish. "It's worse than Welsh," he says at the end of the evening. "I'll need a lot of practice. Come to my house," he says. "Give us notice and we'll pickle some herring, otherwise it's potluck." There's something wrong when you arrive home at dusk but torches are burning. The air is sweet, and you feel so well as you walk in, you feel young, unscarred. Then you see the dismayed faces. They turn away at the sight of you. Mercy comes and stands before him, but here is no mercy. "Say it," he begs her. She looks away when she says, "I am so sorry." He thinks it's Gregory. He thinks his son is dead. Then he half knows, because where is Liz? He begs her. "Say it."
"We looked for you. We said, Rafe, go and see if he's at Gray's Inn and bring him back, but the gatekeepers denied they'd seen you the whole day. Rafe said, trust me, I'll find him if I go over the whole city, but not a sign of you."
He remembers the morning, the damp sheets, her damp forehead. "Liz," he thinks, "didn't you fight?
If I had seen your death coming, I would have taken him and beaten in his death's head. I would have crucified him against the wall. The little girls are still up, though someone has put them into their nightdresses, as if it were an ordinary night. Their legs and feet are bare, and their nightcaps, round lace bonnets made by their mother, are knotted under their chins with a resolute hand. Anne's face is like a stone. She has Grace's hand tucked in her fist. Grace looks up at him, dubious. She almost never sees him. Why is he here? But she trusts him and lets him lift her, without protest, into his arms. Against his shoulder, she tumbles at once into sleep, her arms flung around his neck, the crown of her head tucked beneath his chin. "Now, Anne," he says, "we must take Grace to bed because she is little. I know you're not ready to sleep yet, but you must go in beside her because she may wake and feel cold."
"I may feel cold," Anne says.
Mercy walks before him to the children's room. Grace is put down without waking. Anne cries, but she cries in silence. "I'll sit with them," Mercy says, but he says, "I will." He waits until Anne's tears stop flowing and her hand slackens in his. These things happen, but not to us. "Now let me see Liz," he says. The room, which this morning was only their bedroom, is lively with the scent of the herbs they are burning against contagion. They have lit candles at her head and feet. They have bound up her jaw with linen, so already she does not look like herself. She looks like the dead. She looks fearless, and as if she could judge you. She looks flatter and deader than people he has seen on battlefields, with their guts spilled. He goes down to get an account of her deathbed, to deal with the household. "At 10 this morning," Mercy said, she sat down. "Jesus, I am so weary, in the middle of the day's business. Not like me, is it?" she'd said. I said, "It's not like you, Liz." I put my hand to her forehead and I said, "Liz, my darling," I told her, "lie down, get to bed with you. You have to sweat this out." She said, "No, give me a few minutes. I'm dizzy. Perhaps I need to eat a little something." But we sat down at the table and she pushed her food away. He would like her to shorten her account, but he understands her need to tell it over, moment by moment, to say it out loud. It is like a package of words she is making to hand to him. "This is yours now." At midday, Elizabeth lay down. She was shivering, though her skin burned. She said, "Is Rafe in the house? Tell him to go and find Thomas." And Rafe did go, and any number of people went, and they didn't find you. At 12:30, she said, "Tell Thomas to look after the children." "And then what?" She complained her head ached. "But nothing to me, no message?" "No." She said she was thirsty, nothing more. But then Liz, she never did say much. At 1:00, she called for a priest. At 2:00, she made her confession. She said she had once picked up a snake in Italy. The priest said it was the fever speaking. He gave her absolution. And he could not wait, Mercy said. He could not wait to get out of the house. He was so afraid he might take the contagion and die. At 3:00 PM, she declined. At 4:00, she put off the burden of this life. "I suppose," he says, "she will want to be buried with her first husband." "Why should you think that?" "Because I came more lately." He walks away. There is no point writing the usual directions about mourning clothes, beadsmen, candles. Like all the others touched by this sickness, Liz must be buried quickly. He will not be able to send for Gregory or call the family together. The rule is for the household to hang a bunch of straw outside the door as a sign of infection, and then restrict entry for 40 days
and go abroad as little as possible. Mercy comes in and says, "A fever, it could be any fever. We don't have to admit to the sweat. If we all stayed at home, London would come to a standstill." "No," he says. "We must do it. My Lord Cardinal made these rules, and it would not be proper for me to scant them." Mercy says, "Where were you anyway?" He looks into her face. He says, "You know little Bilney? I was with him. I warned him. I said he will jump into the fire. And later? Later I was learning Polish." "Of course, you would be," she says. She doesn't expect to make sense of it. He never expects to make any better sense of it than it makes now. He knows the whole of the New Testament by heart, but find a text. Find a text for this. Later, when he thinks back to that morning, he will want to catch again that flash of her white cap, though when he turned, no one was there. He would like to picture her with the bustle and warmth of the household behind her, standing in the doorway saying, "Tell me when you're coming home." But he can only picture her alone at the door, and behind her is a wasteland and a blue-tinged light. He thinks of their wedding night, her trailing taffeta gown, her little wary gesture of hugging her elbows. Next day she said, "That's all right then," and smiled. That's all she left him. Liz, who never did say much. For a month he is at home. He reads. He reads his testament, but he knows what it says. He reads Petrarch, whom he loves. Reads how he defied the doctors. When they had given him up to fever, he lived still. And when they came back in the morning, he was sitting up writing. The poet never trusted any doctor after that. But Liz left him too fast for physician's advice, good or bad, or for the apothecary with his cassia, his galangale, his wormwood, and his printed cards with prayers on. He has got Niccolò Machiavelli's book, Principalities. It is a Latin edition, shoddily printed in Naples, which seems to have passed through many hands. He thinks of Niccolò on the battlefield, of Niccolò in the torture chamber. He feels he's in the torture chamber, but he knows that one day he will find the door out, because it is he who has the key. Someone says to him, "What is in your little book?" And he says, "A few aphorisms, a few truisms, nothing we didn't know before." Whenever he looks up from his book, Rafe Sadler is there. Rafe is a slight boy, and the game with Richard and the others is to pretend not to see him and say, "I wonder where Rafe is." They're as pleased with this joke as a bunch of three-year-olds might be. Rafe's eyes are blue, his hair is sandy brown, and you couldn't take him for a Cromwell. But still, he is a tribute to the man who brought him up, dogged, sardonic, quick on the uptake. He and Rafe read a book about chess. It is a book printed before he was born, but it has pictures. They frown over them, perfecting their game. For what seems like hours, neither of them makes a move. "I was a fool," says Rafe, a forefinger resting on the head of a pawn. "I should have found you. When they said you weren't at Gray's Inn, I should have known you were." "How could you have known? I'm not reliably where I shouldn't be. Are you moving that pawn or just patting it?" "Jaboob." Rafe snatches his hand away. For a long time they sit gazing at their pieces, at the configuration which locks them in place. They see it coming. Stalemate. "We're too good for each other." "Well, perhaps we ought to play against other people." "Later, when we can wipe out all comers." Rafe says, wait. He seizes his knight and makes it leap. Then he looks at the result, aghast. "Rafe, you are foutu." "Not necessarily." Rafe rubs his forehead. "You might yet do something stupid." "Right. You live in hope." Voices murmur. Sunlight outside. He feels he could almost sleep. But when he sleeps, Liz Wicks comes back, cheerful and brisk. And when he wakes, he has to learn the lack of her all over again. From a distant room, a child is crying. Footsteps overhead. The crying stops. He picks up his king and looks at the base of it, as if to see how it is made. He murmurs, "Jadoub." He puts it back where it was. Anne Cromwell sits with him as the rain falls and writes her beginner's Latin in her copybook. By St. John's Day, she knows all common verbs. She is quicker than her brother, and he tells her so. "Let me see," he says, holding out his hand for her book. He finds that she has written her name over and over. Anne Cromwell, Anne Cromwell. News comes from France of the cardinal's triumphs, parades, public masses, and extempore Latin orations. It seems that once disembarked, he has stood on every high altar in Picardy and granted the worshippers remission of their sins. That's a few thousand Frenchmen free to start all over again. The king is chiefly at Beaulieu, a house in Essex he has recently bought from Sir Thomas Boleyn, whom he has made Viscount Rochford. All day he hunts, undeterred by the wet weather. In the evening he entertains. The Duke of Suffolk and the Duke of Norfolk join him at private suppers, which they share with the new Viscount. The Duke of Suffolk is his old friend, and if the king said, "Knit me some wings so I may fly," he would say, "What colour?" The Duke of Norfolk is, of course, chief of the Howard family and Boleyn's brother-in-law. A sinewy little twitcher, always twitching after his own advantage. He does not write to the cardinal to tell him that everybody in England is saying that the king means to marry Anne Boleyn. He doesn't have the news the cardinal wants, so he doesn't write at all. He gets his clerks to do it, to keep the cardinal updated on his legal affairs, his finances. "Tell him we are all well here," he says. "Tender him my respects and my duty. Tell him how much we would like to see his face." No one else in the household falls sick. This year London has escaped lightly, or at least everyone says so. Prayers of thanksgiving are offered in the city churches, or prayers of appeasement, perhaps one should call them. In the little conclaves that meet at night, God's purpose is interrogated. London knows that it sins, as the Bible tells us. A merchant shall hardly keep himself from doing wrong. And elsewhere it is stated, "He that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent." It is a sure sign of troubled minds, the habit of quotation. "Whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth." By early September, the plague has run its course, and the family is able to gather to pray for Liz. Now she can have the ceremonies that were denied her when she left them so suddenly. Black coats are given to 12 poor men of the parish, the same mourners who would have followed her coffin, and each man in the family has pledged 7 years of masses for her soul. On the day appointed, the weather clears briefly, and there is a chill in the air. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. The small child Grace wakes in the night and says that she sees her mother in her shroud. She does not cry like a child, noisy and hiccuping, but like a grown woman, weeping tears of dread. All the rivers run into the sea, but the seas are not yet full. Morgan Williams shrinks year by year. Today especially he looks small and grey and harassed as he grips his arm and says, "Why the best taken? Ah, why are they?" Then, "I know you are happy with her, Thomas." They are back at Austin Friars, a swarm of women and children and robust men whom mourning hardly takes out of their customary black, the garb of lawyers and merchants, of accountants and brokers. There is his sister, Bet Wellyfed, her two boys, her little daughter Alice. There is Cat. His sisters have their heads together, deciding who shall move in to help out Mercy with the girls, until you marry again, Tom. His nieces, two good little girls, still clutch their rosary beads. They stare around them, unsure what they must do next. Ignored as the people talk over their heads, they lean against the wall and flick their eyes at each other. Slowly they slide down the wall, straight-backed, till they're the height of two-year-olds and balancing on their heels. "Alice! Joanne!" someone snaps. Slowly they rise, solemn-faced, to their proper heights. Grace approaches them. Silently they trap her, take off her cap, shake out her blonde hair and begin to plait it. While the brothers-in-law talk about what the cardinal is doing in France, his attention strays towards her. Grace's eyes grow wide as her cousins draw her hair back tight. Her mouth opens in a silent gape, like a fisher's mouth. When one squeak escapes her, it is Liz's sister, the elder Joanne, who crosses the room and scoops her up. Watching Joanne, he thinks, as he often has, how alike the sisters are, were. His daughter Anne turns her back on the women, slides her arm into her uncle's. "We're talking about the Low Countries trade," Morgan tells her. "One thing's for sure, uncle, they won't be pleased in Antwerp if Wolsey signs a treaty with the French."
"That's what we're saying to your father, but oh, he was stick by his cardinal. Come, Thomas, you don't like the French any more than we do."
He knows, as they do not, how much the cardinal needs the friendship of King Francois. Without one of the major powers of Europe to speak for him, how will the king get his divorce?
"Treaty of perpetual peace? Let's think, when was the last perpetual peace? I'll give it 3 months."
It is his brother-in-law, Wellyfed, who speaks, laughing, and John Williamson, who is Joanne's husband, asks will they take bets on it? 3 months? 6? Then he remembers they're at a solemn occasion.
"Sorry, Tom," he says, and breaks into a spasm of coughing.
Joanne's voice cuts across it. "If the old gamester keeps coughing like this, the winter will finish him off, and then I'll marry you, Tom."
"Will you?"
"Oh, for sure. As long as I get the right piece of paper from Rome." The party smile and hide their smiles. They give each other knowing looks. Gregory says, "Why is that funny? You can't marry your wife's sister, can you?" He and his boy cousins go off into a corner to talk about private subjects. Bet's boys, Christopher and Will, Cat's boys, Richard and Walter. Why do they call that child Walter? Did they need a reminder of their father, lurking around after his death, to remind them not to get too happy? The family never meet, but he thanks God that Walter's not with them any more. He tells himself he should have more kindness towards his father, but his kindness extends only to paying for masses for his soul. In the year before he came back to England for good, he had crossed and recrossed the sea undecided. He had so many friends in Antwerp, besides good business contacts, and as the city expanded, which it did every year, it seemed more and more the right place to be. If he was homesick, it was for Italy, the light, the language, Tommaso, as he had been there. Venice had cured him of any nostalgia for the banks of the Thames. Florence and Milan had given him ideas more flexible than those of people who had stayed at home. But something pulled at him. Curiosity about who was dead and who'd been born. A desire to see his sisters again and laugh. One can always laugh somehow about their upbringing. He had written to Morgan Williams to say, "I'm thinking of London next, but don't tell my father. Don't tell him I'm coming home." During the early months, they tried to coax him. "Look, Walter's settled down. You wouldn't know him. He's eased back on the drink. Well, he knew it was killing him. He keeps out of the law courts these days. He's even served his turn as church warden." "What?" he said. "And he didn't get drunk on the altar wine? He didn't make off with the candle funds?" Nothing they said could persuade him down to Putney. He waited more than a year till he was married and a father. Then he felt safe to go. It was more than 12 years he'd been out of England. He'd been taken aback by the change in people. He left them young and they had softened or sharpened into middle age. The lissom were lean now and dried out. The plump were plumper. Fine features had blurred and softened. Bright eyes were duller. There were some people he didn't recognise at all, not at first glance. But he would have known Walter anywhere. As his father walked towards him, he thought, I'm seeing myself in 20, 30 years, if I'm spared. They said that drink had nearly done for him, but he didn't look half dead. He looked as he had always looked, as if he could knock you down and might decide to do it. His short, strong body had broadened and coarsened. His hair, thick and curling, had hardly a thread of grey. His glance was skewering, small eyes, bright and golden brown. You need good eyes in a smithy, he used to say. You need good eyes wherever you are, or they'll rob you blind. Where have you been? Walter said. Where once he would have sounded angry, he now sounded merely irritated. It was as if his own son had been on a message to Mortlake and had taken his time over it. Oh, here and there, he said. You look like a foreigner. I am a foreigner. So what have you been doing? He could imagine himself saying this and that. He did say it. And what sort of this and that are you doing now? I'm learning the law. Law? Walter said. If it weren't for the so-called law, we'd be lords of the manor and a whole lot of other manors around here. That is, he thinks, an interesting point to make. If you get to be a lord by fighting, shouting, being bigger, better, bolder, and more shameless than the next man, Walter should be a lord. But it's worse than that. Walter thinks he's entitled. He'd heard it all his childhood. The Cromwells were a rich family once. We had estates. When? Where? He used to say. Walter would say, somewhere up in the north, up there, and yell at him for quibbling. His father didn't like to be disbelieved, even when he was telling you an outright lie. So how do we come to such a low place? He would ask, and Walter would say it was because of lawyers and cheats and lawyers who are all cheats and who thieve land away from its owners. Understand it if you can, Walter would say, for I can't, and I'm not stupid, boy. How dare they drag me into court and fine me for running beasts on the so-called common? If all had their own, that would be my common. Now, if the family's land was in the north, how could that be? No point saying this. In fact, it's the quickest way to get a lesson from Walter's fist. But was there no money? He'd persist. What happened to it? Just once, when he was sober, Walter had said something that sounded true and was, by his lights, eloquent. I suppose, he said, I suppose we pissed it away. I suppose once it's gone, it's gone. I suppose fortune, when it's lost, it will never visit again. He thought about it over the years. On that day when he went back to Putney, he'd ask him, if ever the Cromwells were rich, and I were to go after what's left, would that content you? His tone was meant to be soothing, but Walter was hard to soothe. Oh, yes. Share it out, I suppose. You and bloody Morgan that you're so thick with. That's my money, if all have their own. It would be family money. What are we doing, he thought, quarrelling right off, rowing within 5 minutes over this non-existent wealth. You have a grandson now, he added, not aloud, and you aren't coming anywhere near him. Oh, I have those already, Walter said. Grandsons? What is she, some Dutch girl? He told him about Liz Wicks, admitting, therefore, that he had been in England long enough to marry and have a child. Caught yourself a rich widow, Walter said, sniggering. I suppose that was more important than coming to see me. It would be. I suppose you thought I'd be dead. Lawyer, is it? You were always a talker. A slap in the mouth couldn't cure it. But God knows you tried. I suppose you don't admit to the smithy work now, or helping your Uncle John and sleeping among the turnip shavings. Good godfather, he'd said.
They didn't eat turnips at Lambeth Palace. Cardinal Morton eat turnips? What are you thinking?
When he was a little boy and his Uncle John was a cook for the great man, he used to run away to Lambeth to the palace because the chances of getting fed were better. He used to hang around by the entrance nearest the river. Morton hadn't built his big gateway then, and watched the people come and go, asking who was who, and recognising them next time by the colours of their clothes and the animals and objects painted on their shields.
"Don't stand about," people bellowed at him. "Make yourself useful."
Other children than he made themselves useful in the kitchen by fetching and carrying, their small fingers employed in plucking songbirds and hulling strawberries. Each dinner time, the household officers formed up in procession in the passages off the kitchens, and they carried in the tablecloths and the principal salt. His Uncle John measured the loaves, and if they were not just right, they were tossed into a basket for the lower household. Those that passed his test, he counted as they went in. Standing by him, pretending to be his deputy, he learned to count. Into the great hall would go the meats and the cheeses, the sugared fruits and spiced wafers to the Archbishop's table. He was not a cardinal then. When the scrapings and remnants came back, they were divided up. First choice to the kitchen staff, then to the almshouse and the hospital, the beggars at the gate. What wasn't fit for them would go down the line to the children and the pigs. Each morning and evening the boys earned their keep by running up the back staircases with beer and bread to put in the cupboards for the young gentlemen who were the cardinal's pages. The pages were of good family. They would wait at table and so become intimate with great men. They would hear their talk and learn from it. When they were not at the table, they were learning out of great volumes from their music masters and other masters who passed up and down the house holding nosegays and pomanders who spoke in Greek. One of the pages was pointed out to him, Master Thomas More, whom the Archbishop himself says will be a great man, so deep his learning already, and so pleasant his wit. One day he brought a wheaten loaf and put it in the cupboard and lingered, and Master Thomas said, "Why do you linger?" But he did not throw anything at him. "What is in that great book?" he asked. And Master Thomas replied, smiling, "Words, words, just words." "Master More is 14 this year," someone says, "and is to go to Oxford." He doesn't know where Oxford is, or whether he wants to go there or has just been sent. A boy can be sent, and Master Thomas is not yet a man. 14 is twice 7. "Am I 7? He asks. "Don't just say yes. Tell me, am I?" His father says, "For God's sake, Cat, make him up a birthday. Tell him anything, but keep him quiet." When his father says, "I'm sick of the sight of you," he leaves Putney and sets off to Lambeth. When Uncle John says, "We've plenty of boys this week, and the devil finds work for idle hands," he sets off back to Putney. Sometimes he gets a present to take home. Sometimes it is a brace of pigeons with their feet tied together and gaping bloody beaks. He walks along the river bank, whirling them about his head. And they look as if they are flying, till somebody shouts at him, "Stop that!" He can't do anything without someone shouting. "Is it any wonder," John says, "when you are into any mischief going, prone to giving back answers and always reliably to be found where you shouldn't be?" In a small cold room off the kitchen passages, there is a woman called Isabella who makes marzipan figures for the Archbishop and his friends to make plays with after supper. Some of the figures are heroes, such as Prince Alexander, Prince Caesar. Some are saints. "Today I'm making St. Thomas," she says. One day she makes marzipan beasts and gives him a lion. "You can eat it," she says. He would rather keep it, but Isabella says it will soon fall to pieces. She says, "Haven't you got a mother?" He learns to read from the scribbled orders for wheat flour or dried beans, for barley and for duck's eggs that come out of the steward's pantries. For Walter, the point of being able to read is to take advantage of people who can't, For the same purpose one must learn to write. So his father sends him to the priest. But again, he is always in the wrong. For priests have such strange rules. He should come to the lesson specially, not on his way from whatever else he's doing, not carrying a toad in a bag or knives that one's sharpening and not cut and bruised either from one of those doors called Walter, that he's always walking into. The priest shouts and forgets to feed him, so he takes off to Lambeth again. On the days when he turns up in Putney, his father says, "Where by the sweet saints have you been?" Unless he's busy inside on top of a stepmother. Some of the stepmothers last such a short time that his father's done with them and kick them out by the time he gets home. But Cat and Bet tell him about them, screeching with laughter. Once when he comes in, dirty and wet, that day's stepmother says, "Who does this boy belong to?" and tries to kick him out into the yard. One day, when he is nearly home, he finds the first Bella lying in the street, and he sees that nobody wants her. She is no longer than a small-sized rat, and so shocked and cold that she doesn't even cry. He carries her home in one hand, and in the other a small cheese wrapped in sage leaves. The dog dies. His sister Bet says, "You can get another." He looks in the street but never finds one. There are dogs, but they belong to somebody. It can take a long time to get to Putney from Lambeth, and sometimes he eats the present, if it's not raw. But if he only gets a cabbage, he kicks it and rolls it and thrashes it till it's utterly, utterly destroyed. At Lambeth, he follows the stewards around, and when they say a number, he remembers it. So people say, if you haven't time to write it down, just tell John's nephew. He will cast an eye on a sack of whatever's been ordered in, then warn his uncle to check if it's short weight. At night at Lambeth, when it's still light and all the pots have been scoured, the boys go outside onto the cobbles and play at football. Their shouts rise into the air. They curse and barge into each other. Until somebody yells to stop, they fight with their fists and sometimes bite each other. From the open window above, the young gentlemen sing a part song in the high, careful voices they learn. Sometimes the face of Master Thomas More appears. He waves to him, but Master Thomas looks down without recognition at the children below. He smiles impartially. His white scholar's hand draws closed the shutter. The moon rises. The pages go to their truckle beds. The kitchen children wrap themselves in sacking and sleep by the hearth. He remembers one night in summer when the footballers had stood silent, looking up. It was dusk. The note from a single recorder wavered in the air, thin and piercing. A blackbird picked up the note and sang from a bush by the water gate. A boatman whistled back from the river. 1527. When the Cardinal comes back from France, he immediately begins ordering up banquets. French ambassadors are expected to set the seal on his concordat. Nothing, he says, nothing will be too good for these gentlemen. The court leaves Beaulieu on the 27th of August. Soon afterwards, Henry meets the returned cardinal face to face for the first time since early June. "You will hear that the king's reception of me was cold," Wolsey says, "but I can tell you it was not. She, Lady Anne, was present. This is true." On the face of it, a large part of his mission has been a failure. The cardinals would not meet him at Avignon, made the excuse that they didn't want to go south in the heat. "But now," he says, "I have a better plan. I will ask the Pope to send me a co-legate, and I will try the king's matter in England." "While you were in France," he says, "my wife Elizabeth died." The cardinal looks up. His hands fly to his heart. His right hand creeps down to the crucifix he wears. He asks how it occurred. He listens. His thumb runs over the tortured body of God, over and over, as if it were any lump of metal. He bows his head he murmurs. "Whom the Lord loveth?" They sit in silence. To break the silence, he begins to ask the cardinal unnecessary questions. He scarcely needs an account of the tactics of the summer just past. The cardinal has promised to help finance a French army, which will go into Italy and try to expel the emperor. While this is happening, the Pope, who has lost not just the Vatican but the Papal States, and seen Florence throw out his Medici relatives, will be grateful and obliged to King Henry. But as for any long-term rapprochement with the French, he, Cromwell, shares the scepticism of his friends in the city. If you have been in the street in Paris or Rouen and seen the mother pull her child by the hand and say, "Stop that squalling or I'll fetch an Englishman," you are inclined to believe that any accord between the two countries is formal and transient. The English will never be forgiven for the talent for destruction they've always displayed when they get off their own island. English armies laid waste to the land they move through, as if, systematically, they performed every action prescribed by the codes of chivalry and broke every one of the laws of war. The battles were nothing. It was what they did between the battles that left its mark. They robbed and raped for 40 miles around the line of the march. They burned the crops in the fields and the houses with the people inside them. They took bribes in coin and in kind, and when they were encamped in a district, they made the people pay for every day on which they were left unmolested. They killed priests and hung them up naked in the marketplaces. As if they were infidels, they ransacked the churches, packed the chalices in their baggage, fueled their cooking fires with precious books. They scattered relics and stripped altars. They found out the families of the dead and demanded that the living ransom them. If the living could not pay, they torched the corpses before their eyes, without ceremony, without a single prayer, disposing of the dead as one might the carcasses of diseased cattle. This being so, the kings may forgive each other, the people scarcely can. He does not say this to Wolsey, who has enough bad news waiting for him. During his absence, the king had sent his own envoy to Rome for secret negotiations. The cardinal had found it out, and it had come to nothing, of course. "But if the king is less than frank with me, it does nothing to aid our cause." He has never before met with such double dealing. The fact is, the king knows his case is weak in law. He knows this, but does not want to know it. In his own mind, he has convinced himself he was never married, and so is now free to marry. Let us say his will is convinced, but not his conscience. He knows canon law, and where he does not know it already, he has made himself expert. Henry, as the younger brother, was brought up and trained for the church, and for the highest offices within it. "If His Majesty's brother Arthur had lived," Wolsey says, "then His Majesty would have been the cardinal and not me. Now there's a thought. Do you know, Thomas, I haven't had a day off since I was on the boat, I suppose. Since the day I was seasick, starting at Dover." They had once crossed the narrow sea together. The cardinal had lain below, calling on God, but he, being used to the voyage, spent the time on deck, making drawings of the sails and rigging, and of notional ships with notional rigging, and trying to persuade the captain, "yourself not offended," he said, "that there was a way of going faster." The captain thought it over and said, "When you fit out a merchant ship of your own, you can do it that way. Of course, any Christian vessel will think you're a pirate, so don't look for help if you get in difficulties. Sailors," he explained, "don't like anything new." "Nor does anyone else," he said, "not as far as I can see." There cannot be new things in England. There can be old things freshly presented, or new things that pretend to be old. To be trusted, new men must forge themselves an ancient pedigree like Walter's, or enter into the service of ancient families. Don't try to go it alone, or they'll think you're pirates. This summer, with the cardinal back on dry land, he remembers that voyage. He waits for the enemy to come alongside, and for the hand-to-hand fighting to begin. But for now he goes down to the kitchens to see how they are getting on with their masterpieces to impress the French envoys. They have got the steeple on the sugar-paste model of St. Paul's, but they are having trouble with the cross and ball on top. He says, "Make marzipan lions. The cardinal wants them." They roll their eyes and say, "Will it never end?" Since he returned from France, their master has been uncharacteristically sour. It is not just the overt failures that make him grumble, but the dirty work behind the scenes. Squibs and slanders were printed against him, and as fast as he could buy them up, there was a new batch on the street. Every thief in France seemed to converge on his baggage train. At Compiègne, though he had mounted a day and night guard on his gold plate, a little boy was found to be going up and down the back stairs, passing out the dishes to some great robber who had trained him up. "What happened? Did you catch him?" "The great robber was put in the pillory. The boy ran away. Then one night some villain sneaked into my chamber and carved a device by the window." And next morning, a shaft of early sun, creeping through mist and rain, had picked out a gallows from which dangled a cardinal's hat. Once again the summer has been wet. He could swear it has never been light. The harvest will be ruined. The king and the cardinal exchange recipes for pills. The king lays down cares of state should he happen to sneeze, and prescribes for himself an easy day of music-making or strolling, if the rain abates, in his gardens. In the afternoon, he and Anne sometimes retire and are private. The gossip is that she allows him to undress her. In the evenings, good wine keeps the chills out, and Anne, who reads the Bible, points out strong scriptural commendations to him. After supper, he grows thoughtful. Says he supposes the King of France is laughing at him. He supposes the Emperor is laughing too. After dark, the King is sick with love. He is melancholy, sometimes unreachable. He drinks and sleeps heavily, sleeps alone. He wakes, and because he is a strong man and a young man, still he is optimistic, clear-headed, ready for the new day. In daylight, his cause is hopeful. The cardinal doesn't stop work if he's ill. He just goes on at his desk, sneezing, aching and complaining. In retrospect, it is easy to see where the cardinal's decline began. But at the time, it was not easy. Look back and you remember being at sea. The horizon dipped giddily, and the shoreline was lost in mist. October comes, and his sisters and Mercy and Joanne take his dead wife's clothes and cut them up carefully into new patterns. Nothing is wasted. Every gubbet of cloth is made into something else. At Christmas, the court sings,
"As the holly groweth green, and ever changes hue, so I am and hath been unto my lady true. Green groweth the holly, so doth the ivy, the winter blasts blow ever so high. As the holly groweth green, with ivy all alone, when flowers cannot be seen, and greenwood leaves be gone, green groweth the holly."
Spring, 1528. Thomas More, ambling along, genial, shabby.
"Just the man," he says. Thomas Cromwell, just the man I want to see."
He is genial, always genial. His shirt collar is grubby.
"Are you bound for Frankfurt this year, Master Cromwell?"
"No.
I thought the Cardinal might send you to the fair to get among the heretic booksellers. He is spending a deal of money buying up their writings, but the tide of filth never abates. Moore, in his pamphlets against Luther, calls the German shit. He says that his mouth is like the world's anus. You would not think that such words would proceed from Thomas Moore, but they do. No one has rendered the Latin tongue more obscene. Not really my business, Cromwell says. Heretics books. Heretics abroad are dealt with abroad, the church being universal. Oh, but once these Bible men get over to Antwerp, you know. What a town it is. No bishop, no university, no proper seat of learning, no proper authorities to stop the proliferation of so-called translations. Translations of scripture, which, in my opinion, are malicious and willfully misleading. But you know that, of course. You spent some years there. And now Tyndale's been cited in Hamburg, they say. You'd know him, wouldn't you, if you saw him? So would the Bishop of London. You yourself, perhaps. True, true. Moore considers it. He chews his lip. And you'll say to me, well, it's not work for a lawyer running after false translations. But I hope to get the means to proceed against the brothers for sedition, do you see? The brothers, he says. His little joke. He drips with disdain. If there is a crime against the state, our treaties come into play, and I can have them extradited to answer for themselves in a straiter jurisdiction. Have you found sedition in Tyndale's writing? Ah, Master Cromwell. Moore rubs his hands together. I relish you, I do indeed. Now I feel as a nutmeg must do when it's grated. A lesser man, a lesser lawyer, would say, I have read Tyndale's work, and I find no fault there. But Cromwell won't be tripped. He casts it back. He asks me, rather, have you read Tyndale? And I admit it, I have studied the man. I have picked apart his so-called translations, and I have done it letter by letter. I read him, of course I do, by license, from my bishop. It says in Ecclesiasticus, he that toucheth pitch shall be defiled, unless his name's Thomas Moore. Well, now, I knew you were a Bible reader, most apt. But if a priest hears a confession, and the matter be wanton, does that make the priest a wanton fellow himself? By way of diversion, Moore takes his hat off and absently folds it up in his hands. He creases it in two. His bright, tired eyes glance around, as if he might be confuted from all sides. And I believe the Cardinal of York has himself licensed his young divines at Cardinal College to read the sectary's pamphlets. Perhaps he includes you in his dispensations, does he? It would be strange for him to include his lawyer, but then it's strange work for lawyers altogether. We've come around in a circle, he says. Moore beams at him. Well, after all, it's spring. We shall soon be dancing around the Maypole. Good weather for a sea voyage. You could take the chance to do some wool trade business, unless it's just men you're fleecing these days. And if the Cardinal asked you to go to Frankfurt, I suppose you'd go. Now, if he wants some little monastery knocked down, when he thinks it has good endowments, when he thinks the monks are old, Lord bless them, and a little wandering in their wits, when he thinks the barns are full, and the ponds well stocked with fish, the cattle fat, and the abbot old and lean, off you go, Thomas Cromwell, north, south, east or west, you and your little apprentices. If another man was saying this, he'd be trying to start a fight. When Thomas Moore says it, it leads to an invitation to dinner.
Come out to Chelsea, he says. The talk is excellent, and we shall like you to add to it. Our food is simple, but good.
Tyndale says a boy washing dishes in the kitchen is as pleasing to the eye of God as a preacher in the pulpit or the apostle on the Galilee shore. Perhaps, he thinks, I won't mention Tyndale's opinion. Moore pats his arm.
Have you no plans to marry again, Thomas? No? Perhaps wise. My father always says choosing a wife is like putting your hand into a bag full of writhing creatures with one eel to six snakes. What are the chances you'll pull out the eel?
Your father has married, what, three times?
Four,
he smiles. The smile is real. It crinkles the corner of his eyes.
You're beadsman, Thomas,
he says as he ambles away. When Moore's first wife died, her successor was in the house before the corpse was cold. Moore would have been a priest, but human flesh called to him with its inconvenient demands. He did not want to be a bad priest, so he became a husband. He had fallen in love with a girl of 16, but her sister, at 17, was not yet married. He took the elder so that her pride should not be hurt. He did not love her. She could not read or write. He hoped that might be amended, but seemingly not. He tried to get her to learn sermons by heart, but she grumbled and was stubborn in her ignorance. He took her home to her father, who suggested beating her, which made her so frightened that she swore she would complain no more.
And she never did, Moore will say, though she didn't learn any sermons either.
It seems he thought the negotiations had been satisfactory. Honour preserved all round. The stubborn woman gave him children, and when she died at 24, he married a city widow, getting on in years and advanced in stubbornness, another one who couldn't read. There it is. If you are so lenient with yourself as to insist on living with a woman, then for the sake of your soul, you should make it a woman you really don't like. Cardinal Campeggio, whom the Pope is sending to England at Wolsey's request, was a married man before he was a priest. It makes him especially suitable to help Wolsey, who, of course, has no experience of marital problems, on the next stage of the journey to thwart the king in his heart's desire. Though the Imperial Army has withdrawn from Rome, a spring of negotiations has failed to yield any definite result. Stephen Gardiner has been in Rome with a letter from the Cardinal praising the Lady Anne, trying to disabuse the Pope of any notion he may entertain that the King is being willful and whimsical in his choice of bride.
This ends Disc 4.